Chapter 8. The Chosen. As 1924 dawned, America's largest movie studios had been established in Hollywood, and a virtual torrent of films were being made and exported throughout the world. Through these films, America's way of life, its hopes, dreams, and aspirations, even its political, legal, and judicial systems, were being exported to Europe and Asia. Calvin Coolidge, who had become president upon the death of Warren Harding, promised to continue the return to normalcy that started after the end of the Great War 5 years before. Despite the discordant tones of the growing Teapot Dome scandal, 1924 looked like a good year for most Americans, unless they were in the military. For the military, 1924 started as another year of devastating budget cuts and continuing losses of personnel and resources. The dwindling Army and Navy competed with each other for the meager scraps of diminishing funds thrown to them by a diffident Congress and a penurious new president. In Europe and Japan, aviation flourished, awash in generous government funding. They had seen the future during the war and knew it lay in aviation. Foreign factories worked overtime to produce advanced engine and airframe designs while the United States stagnated, content to consume the surplus, antiquated, defective aviation remnants left over from the war. The factors arrayed against the world flight success were awesome. Scarcely 20 years after the Wright brothers' first flight, most countries had never seen an airplane. With only a few exceptions along the flight route, there were no airports, no aircraft fuel, no spare parts, no outside help or tools of any kind. Available engines were notoriously unreliable and airframes fragile. Navigational aids were primitive at best. The crew would have to fight their way through the blinding blizzards of Alaska, the typhoons of Japan and China, the monsoons of Burma and India, and the sandstorms of the deserts. If they survived all that, lying in wait were the monstrous icebergs of the North Atlantic, many rising unseen thousands of feet into the sky, shrouded in the impenetrable fog of the Arctic regions. Pilots would have to face these elements in open cockpits with only their leather flying suits and their indomitable will to survive protecting them against the ravages of nature. Headwinds on their westbound flight route would slow their lumbering aircraft and make forward progress agonizingly slow. Their route had never been attempted before. No aircraft had ever crossed the Pacific Ocean nor the North Atlantic. Many countries, such as Iceland and Greenland, had never been visited by aircraft. Many didn't think it possible. Just to start the flight, the planners needed overflight and landing permits from 30 different foreign countries. Strong resistance or even denial was to be expected from some countries. To make it over the great oceans, the crew would have to locate and land next to ships that would be tiny specks often hidden under clouds, immersed in rain, or shrouded in fog on turbulent seas. The naval ships were their sole source of sustenance. Unless they found each and every waiting ship, they would have no fuel, no food, no spare parts, and no way to continue on to safety. If they missed a single ship, they would all perish. Previous experience provided little encouragement. In the first crossing of the Atlantic in 1919, naval pilots missed seeing many of the 24 beacon ships through the typical clouds, fog, and rain. The Northern Pacific promised to be even more hostile. The poor reliability and short life of the Liberty engines required each aircraft to make as many as 6 engine changes during the trip. Engine failures were almost certain. Ocean crossings required heavy pontoons. Sensitivity to weights meant that much of the needed survival equipment could not be carried. All previous attempts at this flight by other countries had failed. Most pilots succumbed to air crashes or were simply lost forever. Gamblers extended odds of 10 to 1 that this attempt would meet the same fate.